Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today, my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I have a meandering conversation about communication. Communication is everything, folks, and Reed and I do our best to explore why. We talk about communication styles, how to navigate conflict, the power of deep and abiding listening, the difference between empathy and compassion, and you even get to hear me attempt an embarrassing impression of Bane from the Batman movies. If you'd like to communicate with us, you can drop a comment below if you're watching on YouTube. You can also email us at psychfrontiers@novamind.ca. If you're listening on a podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please consider communicating your love of the show by giving us a 5-star review. That also communicates the value of our podcast to the podcast patriarchy, which helps expose the show to more people who might benefit from it. You can find myself and Reed on Instagram. I'm at Dr. Steve Thayer. Reed is at Interspace Doctor. Without further delay, let's get talking about communication. And we're back.
Hello.
How's it going, Reed?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It's a beautiful day outside.
It is. We're stuck in here having important conversations.
Spring is springing. When is spring officially?
I think it's past, isn't it?
Well, there was the equinox. But what about the groundhog thing?
Oh, that's February, right?
I just exposed some ignorance.
That's terrible. Get your calendar right.
It feels like spring anyway.
Yeah. Beautiful weather here in Utah. We've decided to lock ourselves in this room to share an important message with our listeners. Mm. We're going to talk about communication today. Broad topic, but we like to pick broad topics that you could speak about for many, many hours, and then just sort of hit highlights or interesting tidbits.
Yeah.
Share them with you folks.
Tell some embarrassing stories if
well,
we dare.
Why not? Why not? Okay. Well, why don't I start our conversation with an embarrassing story?
It should
story.
Be something you said to your wife or kids and put your foot in your mouth.
Let's do it. So communication, right? Communication, we chose this topic in part because it's one of the most important things to the human race.
Yet we're not taught how to do it.
Right. Yeah, we take our cues from the people around us, from our parents typically.
Like Donald Trump.
Yeah, there you go.
I shouldn't say those things
on
an episode.
You just lost half our listeners. So here's my story. When my wife and I were, well, I wasn't pregnant. When she was pregnant with our first child, I remember she came up to me with the great news, right? I'm in the bathroom. I think I was shaving or something. And she came up back in the day when I shaved my face instead of my head.
I've seen photos.
I prefer the beard look now, but so she comes up to me and she's like, I've got some great news. And I'm, oh yeah, tell me. I'm pregnant. And my reaction was this. Are you sure?
Steve.
With skepticism in my face. And I remember just like the look on her face is seared in my memory, just crestfallen. And she kind of cocks her head and she's like, yes, I'm sure. And then she walked away. Right. So, damn it. Communication fail on my part. So we talked about it later and she's like, man, I didn't expect that when I told my husband about the pregnancy of our first child, that his reaction would be skepticism. He'd be like questioning my, ability to test for a pregnancy or how I feel in my body or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was thinking about, or back then I was thinking about, why did I do that? Why did I respond that way?
Mm-hmm.
And this story illustrates a concept in communication that the Gottmans, John and Julie Gottman, you know, marriage therapy researchers, call stories behind conflict. So here we have a conflict between my wife and myself. And the story behind my reaction wasn't that I didn't trust my wife to test her body for pregnancy. It was that I couldn't handle disappointment. When I was a younger man, disappointment was just really hard for me to handle. So one of the ways that I sort of learned, we're talking about learning how we communicate, right? One of the ways that I sort of learned to protect myself from being disappointed by others was to just doubt everything.
Yeah.
Anything that seemed exciting, I would just, I called it defensive pessimism when I was younger. I would just be like, it's probably not true. I'm going to make sure I don't get my hopes up. And then if something good happens, I'll be pleasantly surprised. you know, one of those strategies for emotional defense that we developed that, you know, kind of works and then also kind of hurts us.
Because you were looking at, you had some self-awareness and even called it defensive pessimism, but you weren't looking at the other side of the coin that we are always communicating, no matter what we're saying, or even if we're saying nothing or in our body language. And yeah, and that matters.
Well, and the message that she received might not have been the message I intended.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Which happens all the time.
All the time. If there's one thing, you know, that's more important to people than to understand what's being communicated to them, it's to be understood.
Yeah.
Right? We want to be witnessed. We want to be understood.
Yeah. You hear that as one of the core needs that we each have, more than the need to understand. Because we're always trying to understand. But there is definitely a core innate need to be seen, understood.
So to sort of tie the bow on that story, we my wife and I talked about it. I listened. We'll talk about listening as how important it is for conversation and for communication, excuse me. And, you know, chose not to be defensive. I felt really bad about how my reaction affected her. And then she listened to me explain why I thought I reacted that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sure that when she told me about being pregnant with our second child, that I was very enthusiastic.
Well, there's a happy ending to the story then. Yes. And the beautiful thing about communication is it's okay if we fumble, because part of good communication is what happens next, how we're able to work through those difficult times when we fumble or drop the ball or react.
Right. And maybe it's pretty obvious to our audience why communication is important, why it's an important topic to discuss. But I mean, if you think about it, communication is everything. It's how we function as a society on all levels of society. So, dyads, like I just described, partnership between myself and my wife, family units, cities, you know, local governments, national governments, and the world. You can look at a lot of the scary, terrible things that are happening in our world as the result of, at least in part, a breakdown in effective communication.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of striking to think about what civilizations have fallen because of egos in the game and poor communication, misunderstanding, and how many marriages, partnerships, families have been just fractured or stuck in long periods of suffering and stubbornness because of getting hung up on the literal words that were said and not the feelings behind them, or not trying to really understand.
So are you telling me that there's more to communication than just the literal words that are coming out of our mouths?
You know, it's like we were just saying, it's the, not just what you say, it's not even what you do. It's like the need and the feelings underneath it in both people.
And how do we detect those in other people? I think of, certainly it's the words, but it's how you say the words. So intonation, prosody, it's the volume of the words, it's your facial expressions, it's your body posture.
Yeah.
And there's something energetic, right? And you pick what you decide that means to you. But we were talking sort of before we hit record, not even sort of, we were actually talking before we actually hit record, and about perceiving disapproval, for example, or perceiving sincerity was one of the things we were talking about.
Yeah.
That sometimes you just get a bad vibe from somebody and it's hard to describe why you have that bad vibe. And it might be from a cognitive science perspective, just the sum total of all the micro expressions and stuff that your subconscious is picking up on, because we're social animals and we've evolved to take cues of that sort to decide whether or not somebody's safe or dangerous.
Yeah.
And or it's something energetic.
And it's important to check those too, like our triggers, our assumptions about people. It's really an integration of our thoughts, our feelings, you know, what our body's telling us, what that sense is, what's actually being said, and then doing the work of seeking to understand before we react or jump to a conclusion.
Yeah, seek to understand before trying to be understood.
It's a mantra I use so much, especially, it comes in especially handy in relationships, seek first to understand, or to really love someone is to be generous in your interpretation of their words and their behavior.
And if you have any doubt, listeners, about the validity of what Reed just said, just think about the conversations you have that are the most frustrating. They're usually the conversations with people who aren't listening to you, right? Or who are showing all the signs of not listening to you. They're interrupting you, or, you know, you've said something that you wanted to have an impact and they basically just move on to something different. Yeah. They're not looking at you when you're talking. They're distracted on their phone. Like, those conversations kind of suck because we're not being seen, heard. We don't feel understood. So if you really want to have an impact, if you want people to want to be around you, get good at listening.
Oh yeah.
Get good at seeking to understand.
Yeah. It's a mantra that I can't stress enough or can't thank enough for its role in my life, is seek first to understand.
I got to tell you, it's one of the things people love about seeing therapists or coaches or whatever the most.
They listened.
Because they listen.
Yeah.
You know, and there's jokes in our professional, like, oh, I'm a professional listener. Like, you just pay me to listen because no one else will. But there's, you know, it's so important.
One of the core skills and tools in your toolkit.
Yeah. 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 And a lot of helping professionals, like a lot of therapists, I'll speak for therapists since I am one. We're drawn to this work because we grew up listening.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of us have a sort of a natural disposition to listening. A lot of us are introverts.
Good listener. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's tragic for why people like us have become good listeners. This isn't true of all of us, of course.
The wounded healers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, we became good listeners because there were a lot of people who weren't listening to us.
Hey, whatever gets you to be a badass therapist, Steve.
There you go. There are many roads to badassery.
Yeah, but it is interesting that the pains, the struggles, the wounds, you know, especially along a healing journey, can turn into superpowers because for one big reason, empathy that helps you not only listen, but get in there with them and hold their suffering because you've been there.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's spend some time on empathy. How about that? Because empathy is really, really important for effective communication. And maybe we can talk a little bit about the difference between empathy and compassion, because they're not exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So empathy, I guess the short definition is feeling what other people are feeling, right? Putting yourself in their shoes.
What do you think of the term empath, by the way?
It's kind of funny. It's made its rounds on TikTok. Like, I, as an empath, am X, Y, or Z. And I actually heard, I wish I could remember where I heard this, but it may have been an actual study or just an expert rendering their opinion on this phenomenon of people claiming to be empaths. But they said it's actually, if people are very public about being an empath and like, these are the burdens I have to carry as an empath, that they're actually more likely to be narcissists than than actually empathic. God, I wish I could remember who said this.
But there, yeah, and I could see that. And it is it's funny when those terms get kind of popularized, but you could see where it comes from. Like, there's even this body of literature around highly sensitive children and who, like, in one study they were called orchid children versus dandelion children. Like, orchid children need special tender loving care and attention to the surroundings so they can really thrive. And when they do thrive, wow, those are some superpowers of sensitivity and attunement to others in the world. Or maybe empath skills, but the dandelion children, they're gonna be awesome regardless of. It's like those plants popping out through concrete, you know, can grow anywhere. But so there are individual differences, and we're all on that spectrum somewhere.
And I should probably clarify, this person wasn't shitting on the concept of being an empath entirely. Just that a lot of the people on TikTok
who self-proclaim it,
I think you make a good point. Because some of us are way more sensitive to the emotions, to the subtle communications of others, and some of us are a lot less sensitive.
And you can train it too. In our professions, we learn to become good microprocessors or reading people's subtle body language movements and energy, if you will.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, I felt a lot of empathy and continue to feel a lot of empathy in my work. But in the interest of talking about the difference between empathy and compassion, For me, feeling intense empathy is a draining act. If the empathy I'm feeling for somebody is for something extremely painful, because I'm really feeling it, some portion of it, yeah, myself. And draining doesn't mean bad. It just means I only got so much that I can give. Mm-hmm. And so I learned to sort of alchemize that into compassion, which is, you have your pain over there and I see it, and yeah, I have compassion for your pain over there. I can imagine what it might be like to be, how hard that is for you, but I'm not going to take the burden on myself. I'm not going to allow myself to be weighed down or drained. Instead, yeah, I'm going to use my compassion and my love to help you any way that I can. And then when you walk out of my door, you're gone.
Yeah.
And I don't still have your pain.
Yeah. I love that distinction, because we do in this work strive for compassionate care, and we need to make sure we keep our cups full so we can do the work, mm-hmm, day after day, and we don't take it home and become crushed by it or spill it onto others. And that may sound like, I don't want that to come off the wrong way, but yeah, I had to learn as well the hard way of like getting in there with people and feeling it all, but not getting totally crushed by it.
Right.
You know, like going in with that compassionate stance that people really need. They don't, like, if you get into someone's sorrow and you fall apart and they're falling apart, not only are you not helping, you might be adding to the trauma. Where if we can go in with a corrective experience and help hold them and guide them gently by the hand out of that deep, dark pit of despair, then that's some progress.
Right, yeah, right. So you used a phrase there, Reed, that I would hate for this to come across the wrong way, right? I don't want this to, yeah, come across the wrong way. So I was just having sort of some meta commentary on what we're doing right now, right? Our podcast is, mm-hmm, we're communicating ideas to the public that we think are important. The name of our podcast is Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. That's sort of what it revolves around. But really, I mean, if you've listened to more than three of the episodes, you've noticed we don't always talk about psychedelics. We will today. Don't worry, everybody.
If we remember.
Yeah. And we are going to fail at communicating exactly what we think and how we feel, mm-hmm, completely accurately. And I think, yeah, communication takes courage. If you want to communicate something that's important, or maybe even mildly controversial and important, then you have to open yourself up to the very real possibility and probability that there are going to be people who will misunderstand,
oh yeah,
and be even angry at you or dislike you because of that misunderstanding, or just disagree. They could understand you perfectly and still hate your guts or just think you're wrong.
We've had some comments, yeah, on our podcast where we felt misunderstood, mm-hmm, well-meaning.
In fact, I triggered a listener who came at me hard for something that I said on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And it was really the product of a misunderstanding. Fortunately, I was able to talk to this person, yeah, and all is well after the conversation. But yeah, it happens.
Triggers are friends to follow.
Friends to follow, right?
Welcome, everyone.
Coming to a t-shirt soon.
Yep.
But we were talking about merch as an aside, just a random tangent. My wife was like, oh, you guys should definitely do t-shirts. You should do some kind of merch.
There was a winner who had a rare shirt,
yeah,
with the audiogram of one of the episodes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of cool.
And that winner took it upon themselves to tie-dye basically the sweatshirt, yeah, and made a huge improvement.
That looked dope. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
So yeah. So I took us a little off trail with the meta comment, but we were talking about empathy and compassion and how important, if you want to become a really good communicator, in like any walk of life, let's say you want to communicate your brand to your audience, or you just want to communicate really well to your partner or to your kids, empathy is foundational. If any of you mm-hmm, know who Gary Vee is, this you know, loud and proud character who's an entrepreneur, you know, multimillionaire, whatever, but his big thing is empathy. He always talks about,
yeah,
empathy being the most important attribute.
I think it's key in communication, like, if not the number one factor, because I know we were talking about it in the healing arts as something that And the distinction with compassion is something that you need to be aware of and not totally burn out over. But I think empathetic communication is what we strive for, mm-hmm. right? Or, you know, you could look at it as to be empathetic in communication is to seek to make life wonderful for everyone around you, including yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, you know, I think I'm empathetic, but I don't know, maybe I'm not. How would I work on empathy? How would I work on an empathetic communication? What are some things I could do to be more empathic or empathetic in my communication? I think the biggest thing that I'll just sort of offer to begin with is reflective listening.
Yeah, that's got to be the number one skill. Like, well, first, listening.
Actual listening.
And then asking some clarifying questions, knowing that, like you said, Steve, the, you know, communication is not a perfect science and it's a delicate art. And you do have to, it's not only helpful for you in asking those questions, but it helps the other person feel heard.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a brass tacks definition of reflective listening is, as the name implies, you want to show the person that you heard them, number one, with a reflection back to them. Here's what I think I heard you say, or this is what I heard. So not only does that show the person that you are listening, because if you reflect it back accurately, they'll be like, oh, that he understood me. It also shows that it's important to you that you accurately got their message. So you're communicating that this person that I'm reflecting back to is actually important to me. Because if you weren't important to me, I wouldn't care to clarify. I wouldn't really care if I knew exactly what you were saying.
Shows you're listening, and it helps create that container of safety, something we'll probably talk about as key, especially in crucial, difficult conversations or resolving conflict.
Yes.
Is that, you know, reflective listening accomplishes so many of the key aims of skillful communication.
Right. So not only does it communicate those two things, that, you know, one of the third thing that a reflection communicates is I guess it doesn't communicate this, but the third thing it does is it provides opportunities for clarification. So it's going to lead to a more effective interaction because it's quite possible that your reflection will be inaccurate. And then you give the person the opportunity also to see how they came across. So let's say it's a perfect reflection. It's almost, you know, verbatim what they said, and they say, actually, that's not what I meant.
Yeah.
So that can be really useful because sometimes we'll say things and not know, as we said before, how it came across. So the reflection helps the speaker as much as it helps the listener.
Yeah. And there's this providing empathy or conveying your empathy by sitting there listening and not getting distracted and asking those questions rather than like jumping in with your words or even with fix it mode or reflexive reassurances or something. But then there's also like another part of it worth mentioning, I think, of just receiving empathy or how you can contribute to the two-way dialogue in that way too.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that, receiving empathy. Yeah. I was thinking that the times when I, with my children, for example, that I've been able to deescalate, you know, an argument or, you know, one of my kids is really throwing a fit and he's inconsolable, right? And he won't take any of the suggestions that are being given him. Just listening and just validating almost always takes care of the issue.
Rather than it's easy and tempting to try and reassure or fix, but I'm just amazed by how less helpful those are, especially initially, than just validating. Like empathetic listening and then validate. Oh, that must have been hard. I could see why you would feel that way because, you know, that sucks.
A great example with little kids is like when your kid falls. So let's say, you know, you're at the playground with your little kids, your kid falls, and what do they do first? They usually look at you. I mean, unless they've like broke their freaking arm, but they'll look at you if they're aware of your presence to kind of get a cue. And a lot of times you'll hear parents say, oh, you're okay. You're okay. You're okay. Right.
Yeah.
Which if they're not okay, if they feel terrible, it's really invalidating. It's confusing. Like mom's saying I'm okay, but I actually am in a lot of pain right now.
You start to squash feelings.
Right. Right. And then there are the parents kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum. You know, kid falls down and the parents freak out. like, oh my gosh, are you okay? Are you okay? Mm-hmm. And then they'll go and they'll coddle, like, no, sit down. Like, I know you want to play. No, you need to sit down. You need to wait, which communicates a different kind of message to the kid that you aren't resilient, that pain means you need to, you know, close up. You need mm-hmm. to guard. You're communicating anxiety to the kid.
Yeah.
So if those are the two ends of the spectrum, what's sort of the sweet spot in the middle? So at least this is what I do or try to do. My kids aren't that young anymore, but did when they were younger, is my kid falls down and it's apparent to me that they're not like mortally wounded, but it's obviously painful. I'll just sort of look at them with a fairly neutral but concerned look and say, that hurt. And it's a statement with a slight inflection mm-hmm. implying like, tell me how much it hurt. And then, you know, if they say, yeah, it hurt, if they're crying, I'll say, yeah, it sucks to be hurt. So just some calm validation. And I'm not telling them what to do. I'm not saying get back out there and play. I'm not saying come here and sit mm-hmm. down. I'm waiting for them to decide, knowing that I'm here and I'm tracking. And yeah, for the most part, my kids have been, usually they've been, okay, yeah, I'm good to go. And then they're back to the playground.
Yeah, because if you swoop in, well, like you said, either panic and make it worse for them or invalidate their experience, you know, those have far-reaching consequences through one's life. Like this idea of, oh, you fell off your bike, don't cry, here's an ice cream cone. And, you know, all of a sudden we're linking pain to self-soothing with sugar
right.
or something like that.
Right.
Or just like these things that become habits.
And there's been sort of a reaction to the helicopter or lawnmower or snowplow parenting mm-hmm. Where, you know, we want our kids to be resilient and we don't want to come in and move all the obstacles. We just don't want it to go so far to the other end of the spectrum. And one of the things you can communicate while validating is you can actually handle this too. So as I'm saying, yeah, I know it hurts.
Yeah.
Can you stand? And he stands up. Oh, it kind of hurts. And I know he's, if I'm guessing his ankle's not broken or whatever. Okay. Yeah. I'm with you. I can tell it hurts. Let's try a few steps and then we'll see how it feels, you know? So just this calm, encouraging and validating presence, and you can still teach a kid resilience, and strength in that context.
Oh yeah. Even more so because you've got in there and held them in their pain for a moment so they can get back on their feet rather than like dismissing it or blowing it up. And I think it's an important point too, because after the validation, sure, sometimes some tag team cooperative fixing is useful, or sometimes mm-hmm. there's a role for reassurance, mm-hmm. right? But I think, you know, as a take-home message, just remembering to validate before all else as a general rule goes a long way. And then you can be like, okay, how about we problem solve together?
Right. Yeah. This applies in a lot of contexts. I know I've been using parenting as the example. Incidentally, a good book, parenting book on this, is How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk.
Yeah.
I actually wrote down the author's names because I knew I'd bring it up. Adele Faber and Elaine Maslisch. It's a classic, been around for a long time.
Yeah, it's a good one.
So we're talking about empathy, talking about listening and validation being really, really important variables for effective communication.
Yeah, and along those same lines, I'd say don't listen to the words like we were saying, but more listen to the needs.
Mm.
You know, if you see the humanness in all of us in our communications, and we've got that compassionate spirit, that empathetic, abiding presence, then you're just trying to seek to understand what they're feeling and what is it like to be you. And what is the need underlying that? That goes a long way.
A long way. Yeah. Like a lot of times you'll hear, you know, if let's say your partner says, oh, I can't believe you didn't take out the garbage. And what you're hearing is sort of disdain or criticism for not taking out the garbage. But what might be the need behind the expression?
Yeah. You might need help. You might be feeling overwhelmed. You could go in. Yeah. How different would it be if you went in and be like, hey, partner, I had a long day, you know, can I tell you about it? Or, you know, could you do me a big favor because I've had a long day? And then all of a sudden you're not attacking them, or they're not perceiving this as an attack, you're actually giving them a gift of letting them into your real, vulnerable, authentic world,
right,
to do some loving service, which actually like makes people feel awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that takes some skill too, right? To be able to effectively and accurately communicate your own needs. Sometimes we don't know them, right? So you were talking earlier about, you know, perceiving needs in others. And I think especially in a marriage or a relationship, even if that relationship is a romantic partnership or with your children or with your office mates or whatever, friends, being able to perceive the need behind the statement is a superpower.
Yeah, like it's not easy.
If you can develop that, people are going to love to be around you.
Yeah, and because it is something that takes not just time and energy and skill to develop, you don't have to rely on a mind reading superpower. You can ask them, you can help them, like, oh, like, what are you feeling? Or are you hurt? Or that must have hurt. And getting underneath that, peeling away layers, and you can kind of get to the need that way, because we all need to learn to communicate our needs in the end. And so that's another way we're helping each other instead of just jumping to mind reading.
Yeah, the word curiosity popped into my mind. Like if you can approach conflict with curiosity instead of defensiveness, you open up a lot of possibilities.
Yeah. Yeah, that stance would go a long way as well in the world.
Yeah. Curiosity.
Didn't it kill a cat, though?
It probably has killed many cats, yeah.
So what did Gandhi say? He said, this is kind of unrelated, but he said, don't mistake habit for what's natural. And it makes me think of like just the ways we're taught to communicate, the ways we're modeled through generations show up in our own lives. And then that doesn't mean it's the best way to communicate.
Interesting. Yeah. I've never heard that quote. I like that because you'll see different ways of communicating in different cultures, right? And these could be national cultures. They could be subcultures in a family or in a state or a country or whatever. But yeah, like my dad, his mother was from the UK, and you know, he had a very ironic, sardonic communication style.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't know him, you might feel offended at some of the things he would say. But it's sort of this style of communication. I was listening to this podcast between a guy from the British Isles and a guy from, I think it was Ireland. And they were talking about how Americans are too literal and they take things too personally, and that they have this phrase out there called taking the piss, right? That a lot of times they are critical of one another. And it's understood that this isn't, you don't have to take this too personally. This is just us. This is the way we communicate.
Yeah. Some people are just blunt and they can be quite loving, and it can be quite refreshing communication. It's really about those other factors we're talking about, like the empathy and the listening, the understanding.
Right. Right. Maybe we should talk about communication styles. I feel like that's where we're headed with this conversation. Yeah. When I think about communication styles, I think of, I think of these terms. So there's passive communication style. There's an aggressive communication style, passive aggressive communication.
That's a fun one.
That is a fun one. Unless, you're in a relationship with somebody who's very passive aggressive. And then assertive, right? And what's implied in those categories is that we aspire to be assertive communicators. So maybe we can talk about the differences. They're a little face valid, but what's passive communication?
Like maybe if it's not too much of a bother, you might, maybe I can call you later or something.
Yeah. There's hesitancy. There's a lack of confidence in what you're saying. Sometimes people will, just sort of keep it to themselves and hope that people will understand their needs or what they want.
Yeah. You got to assume that if it's not spoken, communication's hard enough to interpret. Mind reading's even harder.
Right. Yeah, and if people tend toward passivity, they sometimes develop resentment, right? Because they're passive because they don't have a lot of self-confidence, or they're socially anxious, or whatever. And they have needs. They have a hard time communicating those needs. Mm-hmm. And so they build this sort of resentment about not getting those needs met or not being able to communicate the needs clearly.
Yeah. And one of the big pitfalls or ways people stumble is they forget that no one makes you feel that, and they go in like, you
made
did
me
this,
so angry. Yeah,
instead of like, you know, going in there with a soft startup, like John Gottman would advise very wisely so, and say, and just share your feelings, share your honest, open, vulnerable feelings at the right time with a gentle presence. And it's a game changer.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's the classic I and me statements. So as opposed to you make me so angry, it's I'm feeling some anger right now.
Otherwise, it's a blame game, and that no one wins the blame game.
So that's some examples of passive communication. Aggressive is sort of the other end of the spectrum. You don't respect the needs and autonomy and boundaries of others. You're a bull in a china shop. You come in without regard to their needs and demand for what you want. You use criticism or intimidation as strategies to get what you want or to communicate.
Fire, damnation, domination, fear tactics.
Right. You interrupt people.
Demanding, don't do this.
Yeah.
Like, and if you think about it, you're starting to make someone feel like a bird in a cage or a tiger in a cage, and they might feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the stereotype here is like the really aggressive male, the aggressive father figure that comes in and just, you know, makes all the demands, barks all the orders, and then rules with fear, with an iron fist.
Mm-hmm. And a side note on all this is communication isn't only what we say. And it's not only with other people. There's an internal dialogue going on all the time. And it's harder to tune into, but it's also quite shocking to people when they do start to listen to their inner critic or how rough they are on themselves, often even harder on themselves than others. Mm. And I think it's just a little reminder, and we'll probably dive into this more, of being gentle with oneself.
Yeah, how we communicate with ourselves is relevant. Let's bookmark that, because I think that's we should talk about that. I just want to finish fleshing out passive aggressive and then assertive. So passive aggressive is where you're aggressive, but you're doing it with this container of passivity. So, you know, you appear passive on the outside, but you're actually doing kind of aggressive things to communicate your needs. So that's, you know, I'm purposely not going to empty the dishwasher and make my partner empty the dishwasher because they don't appreciate me, right? Sabotaging things.
Yeah, it doesn't get you very far.
No. These people have a difficulty sometimes saying no to requests, so they have that sort of passivity, but then they resent having, quote-unquote, having to do what they've been requested to do. So there's, again, a lot of resentment with that passive style.
And I think the passive-aggressive and the aggressive are missing the empathy component.
Right.
They're not looking for that joyful resolution where everyone's needs get met. They may not believe that's even possible from where things come from. It reminds me of that, narcissistic personality disorder as another kind of common personality type that struggles with communication and struggles with that empathy component. But usually it's because of a deep old wound they have that callous them to all of this this idea that everyone can have their needs met.
Yeah, right. There's a fragile sense of self in there, and it's so much easier to communicate with people using that empathic skill set when you have some confidence about who you are. You don't need to defend yourself when somebody's upset or somebody disagrees because you're okay with you.
Yeah, it reminds me of politicians we were talking about earlier, but I won't go there, as tempting as it is.
Yeah, we don't want to offend, not on purpose at least, although we did have a whole episode on triggers, so yeah, go watch that one, folks.
Yeah, so I guess we've got assertive communication that remains.
So as you can probably guess, it's the kind of communication that isn't those first three. So it's still you value your needs and you're going to speak your needs, but without violating the needs of others, without being dominating, without being critical. You're going to listen well. You're going to make good eye contact, right? You're going to have good communication skills. So it's a respect for yourself. It's a respect for the other person. And there's a lot of empathy and compassion present. But you're not going to sort of flay yourself. You're not putting yourself on the altar for everybody else. You still respect yourself.
These days, you hear the term a lot, speak your truth.
Yeah.
And I think it's touching on that. Like, one of the greatest gifts you can give to those around you is to tell the truth about how you feel and what you need while keeping them in your heart. Like, that's a Ram Dass nugget of wisdom, probably via Maharaji, but he says, do what you do with another person, but never put them out of your heart.
Yeah. And I think some people use the speak your truth idiom as an excuse to just be a tactless asshole. And that's not what you're talking about when you're saying speak your truth, especially with that second part of keeping them in your heart.
Yeah. Like, think about in a kind of romantic relationship situation where two people are dating and one isn't seeing the possibility, but one's way into it. But one of them just can't speak up. They can't tell the other. So they're leading them on. And that's where you hear, I think it was like a Bob Marley quote about how cowardly that is for someone to do to another person's heart. I mean, it's just one example that comes to mind of how, like, speaking your truth is a loving gift if you do it with compassion and empathy.
Right. It's a good example. It's a good example of a passive communication style resulting in suffering for both people, where an assertive style would be not to lead a person on. It would be to, as you described, speak your truth, but with compassion, that compassionate container.
And not to ghost them as like the passive, cowardly way, perhaps, or the passive aggressive.
Yeah. And it does take courage to be assertive. And the times in my life when I've been passive, it's been usually because of fear. Right? It's a lack of confidence that I could navigate this. It's a fear of how they might react. I don't want to hurt them, but I also don't want them to be mad at me. So certainly have compassion for the passive style.
Oh yeah.
When it's motivated by anxiety and fear.
I think we share that common kind of lineage of people pleasing.
Yeah. We've talked about it a lot. We brought it up on the podcast before, and Reed and I just talk about it a lot because we share that common lineage. And I love the book No More Mr. Nice Guy for that reason. I think it's a really good treatment of the people pleasing nice guy syndrome. There's another one called, I wrote it down, Not Nice by Aziz Gezipura. That's not just for men. So it's more of a broadly applicable book about how to be assertive instead of passive, how to please yourself and others, not just people pleasing for the hopes that they'll love you and accept you and won't reject you.
That's not Aziz from Parks and Recreation, is it?
No.
Not that Aziz, because he's
funny.
Not
the comedian. Yeah, not the comedian.
He's written a book, though.
Has he?
I think.
Is it called Not Nice? It's not the same guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it's called or why I brought that up. Put in the show notes.
Similar name. Yeah.
If he wrote a book. Like and subscribe, comment, whatever.
There you go. Yeah. Link us. So yeah, we're talking about something important. It's a total brain fart.
Be clear, precise in your communications. Like, what is the goal? Just like we've talked about in past episodes of healthy, empowered anger.
Right.
Is actually a really cool, awesome thing to embody. So is assertive, clear, loving communication. Even if it might make waves. Yeah, as long as you keep people in your heart.
Right. Yeah. I got to tell you, when you're in a relationship with somebody who is assertive and clear, you feel safer with that person.
Yeah.
Because you know what you're going to get. Even if what they're saying is, you know, you don't agree or it's hurting because it's not what you wanted to hear. When somebody is consistent, being assertive helps you be consistent. When somebody is consistent with their communication, you're just going to feel safer around that person.
So in a parenting dynamic, that shows up as less anxiety and more like more of an ability for a kid to be in their creativity and you know, learn and grow. And in relationship, that safe container is paramount. Like, you don't have that, you're like, it's hard to build on that foundation.
An important foundation, but I agree hard to build.
And so being precise and present and detailed and active in your communications and looking for that solution, like being clear in your requests and looking for that solution that'll enrich everyone's lives. Mm-hmm. Not just theirs, not just yours.
Yeah. Yeah. Making concessions where you feel like you can and want to, but not the kind of concessions that, again, make you resent.
Yeah.
So we could talk about a few more things as we get toward the end of the podcast. I want to talk a little bit about conflict and how to handle conflict. We've dipped in it a couple of times in the meandering conversation today. And then, since we are psychedelic therapy frontiers, we can talk a bit about how psychedelic assisted therapy or psychedelic experience generally affects communication with oneself and with others.
Especially MDMA assisted psychotherapy.
Right. Oh, I did say we bookmark communicating with self. So why don't we start? Why don't we do that first? So you'll hear the phrase self-talk a lot, that you need to upgrade or heal or alter your self-talk. Because we all have that, as you were talking about before, sort of the inner monologue. And we've referenced the concept of parts a lot on this podcast. So sometimes depending on which part has the microphone, you might have a different type of self-talk.
Yeah. And an example that comes to mind might be, say you grew up in a chaotic household where maybe a parent or two had some addictions or weren't taking care of things, and you felt like you had to step up and do it, and the stakes were high, and you're like the oldest kid and there's all these siblings to take care of. You might have developed this really strict personal standard or dialogue of like, you gotta like be better, you gotta do this, or you might just be relaying what was told to you from an angry, wounded parent. But there are certainly ways it shows up from the bosom of the family or from childhood that creates this incessant dialogue of an overactive self-critic later.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think it could be helpful when you become aware of those voices to ask yourself, whose voice is it?
Yeah.
Right. They're all yours, but they often, as you imply, they often come from somewhere. And usually someone.
Yeah. And either it was passed on to you or you needed it for a moment to get through a really chaotic time. Mm-hmm. And now you can lovingly shine some awareness on it and let it go.
Yeah. 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 Because you might not need that particular defense anymore. That particular voice isn't going to serve that purpose anymore. So, yeah, I mean, it probably goes without saying we want to try to have uplifting and realistic, positive self-talk. But, the affirmations movement is kind of gone out of style, in part because a lot of times if you tell people you just need to have really positive affirmations and they'll look in the mirror and say to themselves, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. But if they don't believe it, it doesn't do much. In fact, it can make things worse. So having healthy self-talk is not lying to yourself. But it is also not allowing for a bias that is harmful. So pick an affirmation if you want to use one that at least part of you can believe.
Yeah. So it's not ridding yourself of judgment, because we all have judgment, right? Towards self and others, evolutionarily wired for a lot of different reasons that I won't go down that rabbit hole, but it's more about witnessing your judgment without judgment. And like shining the light of awareness on it to see what's going on. What are you really like judging? If you can go towards people's feelings and your own feelings and their thoughts and words and yours without that judgment and just observe and witness, there's a more expansive starting point to begin.
Yeah. So I'm getting mindfulness vibes from that comment, right?
There's
The skill of observing your thoughts, of observing how you react to your thoughts, and like we were talking about where they come from, is maybe sort of a prerequisite for that experience.
Yeah. And so that's, and then applying that to others, it's not just what they say. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, what are their needs? Like, what are they saying that might convey them? Oh, was there a request there? Mm-hmm. And using that observing, that non-judgmental state of witnessing.
Yeah. I like that.
Because our words create our reality, and kind of, I know that's a bit of a cliche, but I believe it's true because we tell ourselves stories about reality and then we act on them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's an intervention in acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, where you have the client, if they have a particularly nasty inner monologue, right? This train of thoughts that's really self-critical. You have them imagine those thoughts spoken in the voice of a cartoon character. So Steve Hayes, the guy that created ACT, is famous for doing this in Donald Duck's voice because he's really proud of his Donald Duck impression. And so he'll do the Donald Duck impression, saying the most critical thing.
Are you going to try it?
No. I could do a different voice. I could do... I could do Bane from the Batman movies. If I remember, what does he say?
You merely adopted the dark. I was born in it, molded.
That's pretty good. Pretty good. Turn that into a reel.
Yeah. I can also do a good Gollum impression, but I don't know if I want to go there. Nope. I lost the courage. Shoot, what
at least
were we talking
you
about?
Listened. To your inner healing intelligence.
I did. It let me do Bane, but it doesn't want me to do Gollum.
You don't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shoot.
Well, be impeccable with your word. Yeah. To sum it up from, you know, if our words create our reality and these narratives that we kind of act by, we got to be careful what we say, not just to others, but to ourselves.
Right.
'Cause you might be... Like, instead of encouraging yourself, you might be actually throwing energy in the wrong direction, getting in the way of your hopes and dreams by telling yourself you can't do it or you're not good enough, smart enough.
Right.
Things like that. And I think it matters. It matters what we say to ourselves.
Absolutely.
And I also think it's kind of an ego move. I'm going out on a limb here, but it's kind of an ego move to hold yourself to a higher standard, like a more critical standard than you do to others.
Mm.
Like we give others a lot of grace. Like, why don't we give ourselves that grace?
It's interesting. So why might somebody not, right? I think people, sometimes they feel like they have to rely on the critic to keep their edge or to keep them performing or doing the right thing. If I'm not super critical, then I will fail in some way or I'll be rejected by those whose love that I want.
Yeah.
And we have this, I think of what it's
keeps
it's
you from getting hurt.
Exactly. And it's a misunderstanding. It's a false belief,
a
right?
Protector part.
Yeah. There you go. You don't necessarily need it in order to get what you need.
Yeah.
Out of other people, from other people.
But we had it deeply ingrained before we were old enough to know any better. We're not taught how. And then
right.
One day we end up in some kind of awakening or some kind of therapy room or mm-hmm. psychedelic journey. And then we crack things open. We shine a light on the dark corners of ourselves. And we're like, oh, shit.
Right.
I've been quite mean to myself. And your heart can break in that moment. And that can drive you on this path of healing and transformation and growth.
Right. Yeah. So if you can get yourself communication, your self-talk squared away, it'll help you. This is an attempt at a segue to the conflict conversation.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it'll help you be better, be more stable and more effective in a situation where there's conflict, where you're trying to communicate in the midst of conflict. So you have this firm, stable foundation of self-understanding and appreciation and mm-hmm. meeting your own needs. And then you're less likely to get defensive. What are Gottman's four horsemen of the relationship apocalypse, right? They're defensiveness, contempt, criticism, and stonewalling.
Mm-hmm. Those are so good.
Yeah, we usually don't engage in those, right? When we're feeling safe, when we're feeling confident in our ability to communicate our needs.
So good meaning... They're terrible things to do in relationship. Don't try them.
They're useful constructs.
Yeah. The horsemen of the apocalypse are not desirable qualities.
Yeah. Yeah. In case the name wasn't clear enough, right? The four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Yeah. And John Gottman, you know, one of the most brilliant marriage and family therapists out there was able to predict with uncanny accuracy which relationships would struggle and even end in divorce or separation by just watching those four things.
Right. Close to 80% accuracy, if I remember right, at least in one of the studies.
It's impressive. What's your number?
I don't think it's that. But yeah, I mean, I forget what he called it, the love lab or something, where they'd have couples in there and videotape all their interactions, and they'd have expert raters coding for expressions that reflected the emergence or presence of one of those four horsemen.
Yeah.
And I think contempt and criticism were the big killers, if I remember right. Especially contempt, which, you know, probably not hard to understand why.
You want to give an example?
You are an asshole, right? That would be communicating contempt.
Ouch.
Or you never listen.
Yeah.
You're a shitty listener, okay, right? Usually insults.
That's a blame game button you're pushing there. And it's also highlights another communication landmine of ultimatums. You can pretty much throw out the word never or always.
Yeah.
You always do this, or you never do the grocery shopping or whatever. You know that the never is very unlikely to be true, and you know you can just kind of count on the fact that the other is going to have a button push by that,
right,
and they're going to put some weapons up, some defenses up, because that's how it works.
Exactly. Also, the sarcasm, where sarcasm isn't part of, like we were talking about before, it's not part of sort of the communication style of the family, where it's sarcasm to communicate displeasure, but you don't have the courage to be assertive. And you don't have the disposition to be aggressive. You're being a sort of passive aggressive in your sarcasm.
Self-deprecating, perhaps.
Yeah. But being really sarcastic in your criticism of somebody else is another example of communicating contempt for a partner.
Yeah.
So yeah, contempt, not so good. Defensiveness, kind of face valid what that means. When you say, you know, honey, I'm really tired. It would really mean a lot to me if you take the garbage out. Man, get off my back. You're always telling me to do stuff. I was at work all day. I'm super tired, right? You're getting really defensive, throwing up the walls instead of listening and trying to understand the request and having empathy. And you know, the quote unquote right response to that request doesn't always have to be, yes, dear, I will immediately take out the garbage. If you have what you feel like is a valid reason not to, then you open the conversation, right, with empathy and compassion and assertiveness. And you avoid the horseman and the unnecessary conflict.
Yeah, and that brings up another point. It's not only okay to take some time and space when things get heated, but it can be a really important, helpful strategy of just noticing, tuning into your nervous system. And when it's on high alert, or when you notice your weapons are coming up, you're not in that kind of empathetic listening, seeking to understand, like mindful communication. Yeah. Ask for a pause. State that as your need.
Mm-hmm.
And be clear about when you're going to come back to it so they can rest their nervous system too.
Yeah. It's a classic move and a really healthy one. Hey, I'm feeling really activated right now, and I'm not sure that I can have this conversation and be the kind of person I want to be in this conversation. So let's take 24 hours or an hour, whatever, like have it time bound, and then let's come back and talk about it.
It's hard to argue with the other person's experience, right, and their feelings, especially that when you're asking for help, essentially, like, I'm flooded.
Right.
I'm sorry, but I really want to work through this with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So avoid those four horsemen, and you can avoid it with all the other strategies we've been talking about up to this point. Other important, I don't know, aspects to handling conflict. Looking at my notes here, so a general empathic stance toward humanity that most people are kind of doing their best. I remember Brene Brown, who said, this is actually, she's quoting her husband. She said, her husband told her once that he prefers to assume that people are doing their best because he likes himself better when he's making that assumption. He just likes how he is in the world. He's less critical, less resentful when he just assumes that other people are doing their best.
Yeah, that brings up another Brene Brown nugget of wisdom that I really like, is that foundation of trust. She uses the idea of trust jar jars of marbles that we can fill in relationship, especially that give us some resilience and reserves about that mutually seeking to understand one another and, you know, being generous in our interpretations of another, because I think in conflict, we too often assume that it's the words that were said, but when far too often, it's actually the lack of a foundation of safety and trust.
Yeah, I like that. Lack of a foundation of safety and trust. This is a little bit of a tangent, but it's a book about how to handle, how to communicate in conflict. And that's Chris Voss, his book, How to Never Split the Difference. He's a FBI negotiator.
Oh yeah.
He negotiated hostage situations and stuff. And, he talks about building sort of this rapport with the person you're talking to of safety and trust and using a lot of the strategies we've talked about, reflective listening, empathy, what's it like to be them? And so he just comes at it from the lens of negotiation, but really a lot of communication, especially when it's communication between a partnership about your needs, is a negotiation. A lot of communication with your kids is a negotiation.
It's a good point, because you look at the hostage negotiators out there and they have some good communication skills, because you can think how someone with no training, that could be quite dangerous if you just go in and, try and talk someone down.
Right. And it does kind of sometimes feel like you're being held hostage when you're trying to communicate with a four-year-old, who may or may not be holding their sibling hostage.
Right? Yeah.
Some communications can feel like a hostage negotiation.
Another good book is, on the topic is Crucial Conversations, where, you know, the author has a system of sorts, like start with the heart, the why, you know, and then look at that foundation of safety, go in with the intent of creating that safety, because you can't accomplish much without, and then going on from there.
Yeah. I like that. Since we're naming books, another one is, Talking to Crazy by Mark Goldston. I think his name's Mark Goldston. Yeah. Psychiatrist. He's got another book called Just Listen, but, Talking to Crazy is one that I've recommended to a lot of clients who are dealing with what Goldston would call chronically irrational people in their life. And one of the strategies he discusses is understanding the MO, the modus operandi. What is this person? It's kind of like what you were saying before about perceiving their needs, right? What are they really trying to get? What's behind the communication strategy? And it just helps you feel less triggered and defensive and actually speak to the need behind the communication, which will calm people down pretty quick, even if they're being very irrational.
Yeah, because often one of the needs is feeling heard and understood, and you can do that pretty effectively with some basic communication skills.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Or just shutting up.
Yeah.
And listening.
Yeah, it's like that acronym we've brought up before when we talked about psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, the WAIT acronym. Why am I talking?
Yeah.
Just wait and listen. Allow the process.
I bring that into psychedelic therapy rooms all the time, or yoga and meditation classes, to get out of the way of the medicine and not, or the process or the inner healing intelligence or the ones like the individual's own like thoughts and feelings and experience.
So speaking of psychedelics, let's talk about psychedelics and communication briefly as sort of the frosting on this, this cake of an episode. So one of the reasons I'm particularly excited about psychedelic medicine is the way it alters, perception of self and others such that you can communicate things in a way that your ego wouldn't allow you to do otherwise. And I've heard this of couples who have, been in MDMA assisted therapy trials, or people who've just, used cannabis to sort of grease the skids between them and their emotions so that they can communicate in this way. And some really, really exciting stuff that we're hearing from the clinical trial space and places where stuff is legal that isn't legal here, to help people communicate their needs.
Yeah. And one of the mechanisms for that, I think, in the MDMA assisted psychotherapy realm is that the medicine gives this really powerful sense of safety and trust towards oneself and towards others, especially those you're interacting with in the room. And that's why MDMA has been so helpful through the ages. Like decades ago when it was used routinely in couples therapy, I talked to some of our mentors and like some of the older kind of MAPS researchers, trainers who did that work before it was taken away. And they've said things like, oh, I miss that medicine because it made me feel like a badass therapist.
Yeah.
And it's true. Taking a medicine that gives this release of oxytocin, serotonin, norepinephrine, a little dopamine, creating this warm hug around the situation that would otherwise be either inaccessible, like trauma or difficult wounds in relationships. And then through that chemical soup and the magic of that process moves you towards one another in this loving way.
Yeah. I like the way you describe that. The safety piece seems like it's the big piece. Because oftentimes we're not saying what we want to say because we just are afraid. We don't feel safe that we're going to be heard or understood.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't go into conflict resolution without a sense of safety. Yeah.
And of course, you know, we often make the caveat that psychedelics aren't a panacea. People will come out of those experiences and sometimes have a little bit of vulnerability hangover as their ego comes back online. And sometimes in a psychedelic experience, the communication isn't super productive. Sometimes it's just wacky, and which wacky can be fun, or sometimes it can be a little unnerving. But yeah, good reasons to be excited. Well, anything else about communication, Reed, that you think we should share with our lovely listeners?
No, just a couple little reminders to repeat the things. I know we've been all over the place today,
yeah.
But you know, I think one of the greatest gifts we can give each other is being clear in our communications and being truthful and loving about what we need and our understanding and seeking first to understand the other.
Well said.
Yeah.
Thanks, Reed.
Thank you.
Thank you, dear listener, for listening. It means a lot to me. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Novamind, a mental health company that specializes in psychedelic medicine and research. You can learn more about Novamind's mission to increase access to legal, safe, and evidence-based psychedelic medicine at novamind.ca. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're using to listen or watch. Also, if you're feeling generous today, please leave us a glowing review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you'd like to reach out to us with questions, suggestions, scathing criticisms, etc., please email us at psychfrontiers@novamind.ca. Thanks again. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.